He was a humble man. He had important historic accomplishments, but he did not see himself as a great man. Confident? Yes. And yet humble, because he always looked to the whole planet, all of humanity, and the enormity of the need. Climate change, mass extinction, inequality, intolerance, and the inadequacy of our collective response. Cliff measured himself against those challenges, fully conscious of this miracle that we call life. He grew up in prosperous post-war America of the 50s and 60s. Like many of us back then, he saw that the system was deeply flawed, in need of radical solutions. At his University of Maryland graduation, he wore a big red fist on the back of his gown. He sought a better world, a better society, and he believed that business as usual or half measures were not going to get us there. And he had a mystical side and felt a calling to his more spiritual nature. In 1971, he moved onto a bus with Anita, joined others on a big caravan, and landed in rural Tennessee as a founding member of the farm. I met him on the farm at the beginning of 1972, just past my 21st birthday. He had the thickest, blackest hair I had ever seen. I didn't work with him in our early farm days, but we hung out socially. We shared a love of satire and irony. The bite of his wit resonated with me, and he had a great snickering laugh. We shared a wavelength early on, and we knew that no matter what we ran into, we could laugh about it. We at the farm threw ourselves into our community life completely, to the point of not even having our own money. Living and working together, we bonded heavily with each other along the way. In 1974, the farm created a nonprofit service organization, Plenty International. In the mid-1970s, the farm experienced a kind of diaspora with groups of us emigrating to various cities and countries to start and populate satellite communities. In 77, Cliff and Anita and their kids moved to a modest house in Washington, D.C., along with two other couples and their kids. The idea was that the farm's advocacy of certain issues justified an articulate and reliable spokesperson in Washington, and that person was Cliff. But there were a lot of bills to pay, so our hippie ambassador, as one press story called him, created a day job for himself remodeling houses in D.C. I moved with my small but growing family to that D.C. house at the beginning of 1978. I won't kid you, it was a crowded household. We chose D.C. principally for the small group of people living there, and in particular for me, that meant Cliff. I'd been a mechanic and a trucker on the farm, but I was confident I could learn to be a productive member of a house remodeling crew led by Cliff, and I went right to work helping him. He was in the middle of a big painting job, so I picked up a brush, bucket, and got to it. Soon, Cliff came over and in a couple of minutes showed me how to triple my speed. And to this day, every time I pick up a paintbrush, I think of him. The house we were in was sold that spring in our group. 8 adults and 12 kids lived in 3 different houses that year. Later that spring, Cliff and I both came down with bad cases of the kind of hepatitis you get from eating contaminated food. So we went from working together to convalescing together all through that hot, muggy D.C. summer. But by fall, we were back on the job. Later that fall, Plenty asked Cliff and his family to move to Guatemala and take lead roles in projects down there. Plenty, in Guatemala since 1976, saw that most rural people had no running water. Cliff had been a core builder of the farm's big home-built water systems, the pumps, the lines, tanks, towers, bathhouse. Cliff worked on all of it. So it was a natural fit. Near the end of the year, Cliff and his whole family moved away. Months later, I was deeply moved when I saw the photo of Cliff in the highlands of Guatemala, a huge volcano in the background, surrounded by men from a village who had helped him engineer the first running water ever for that village. For longer than anyone knew, they had carried water uphill in jugs on their heads. And there he was, in his funky straw hat, baggy peasant clothes, locally woven sash belt, and that black hair and beard, not hiding the big grin on his face as he watches the water come through that pipe for the first time. But the farm dream of egalitarian collective didn't last long, and for a great many of us, the next diaspora in 1983 was final. Many of us left and returned back to where it all started, right here in the Bay Area. Now, Cliff was versatile, quick learner, good with his hands, good with his mind. He was not just a talented carpenter and water system expert. By then, he'd also been the bookkeeper for a thriving farm solar business. He had a ham radio license. He understood electronics. It was no great leap for him to become adept at working with computers. Matthew McClure, who's here today, a close friend to both Cliff and me, who had been with the old Whole Earth catalog, returned as an editor for the new Whole Earth software catalog, and soon Cliff was working at Whole Earth too. In 1985, Matthew switched to becoming the one person managing the newest Whole Earth project, the Whole Earth Electronic Link, aka the Well. Cliff described his pre-well days at Whole Earth like this, and I quote, "I had my head down into doing the Point Foundation's books, or putting together the billing program for the well, or formatting files to be uploaded to the typesetter for the catalog. I was hanging on by my fingernails to any job Whole Earth had for me. I'd helped to do the remodel of the office space. I built the odd-shaped small room that would be the air-conditioned home of something called a VAX 11750. In early 1986, Matthew hired me to work with him at the well. And so Cliff, Matthew, and I worked together again. As Cliff later wrote, we all three agreed the well would not be like the farm. There would be no infallible authority figure. And even if there had to be an ultimate decision maker, community deliberations would have to take place before decisions would be made. It was a business, but it had to be a community with improvements over the commune model that we had experienced. Later that year, Matthew left Whole Earth and hired Cliff to replace him as well general manager. That was 1986. Again, quoting Cliff, that I would end up in the director's chair of this operation a year and a half after its launch was about as conceivable to me as being invited to be an Apollo astronaut. But that's typical of the Whole Earth story. Stuart blessed the idea because he trusted Matthew and he recognized the relationship between social chops learned on a commune and the social savvy required to build an online community. I was scrambling to invent a job I could hold on to that would support my family. But before long, I began to love it. And so it was in 1986. Cliff and I began our five-year run together as managers of the well. The bond between the two of us during those years was so strong, so evident, that people called us Big Tex. Still, and either seriously or ironically, the vile Big Tex. He was a natural leader. He didn't like to tell people what to do. He believed in empowering people. One could describe his way of managing the well with a phrase that I think he first came up with, tools, not rules. Mm-hmm. Cliff and I knew that this was no ordinary work, but it was transforming in real time the lives of people doing it, ourselves included. With the well, we were part creators of a new, different, and deeply meaningful, even historic social tapestry. It is now recognized worldwide as the birth of online community. In those days, we felt it was our sacred duty to help it take hold and thrive. We weren't thinking about getting rich, scaling up, or any of that. We were totally committed to it, laser focused on the self-creation of a new kind of community. By the 1980s, we were profitable, but without any meaningful capital. And then 1992, the well had a new owner and new governance that came with it, so it was time for both of us to move on. But for each of us, our work there defined and made possible the rest of our careers and further cemented a friendship that nothing could diminish. Cliff went on to do great things. The principal mover behind numerous online community projects for businesses and nonprofits, he spread his wisdom and reliable advice around widely. He did significant work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, America Online, Salon, numerous other groups. In 97, Cliff organized and managed the accompanying online conversation to the big man versus machine chess match with Garry Kasparov and IBM. And it was a big success with 50,000 registered people reading and commenting. It's important because that was one of the very first examples of running live commentary online into a big live event, something that happens every day now. That was just about the first. He was the author of two highly respected books for online professionals, Hosting Web Communities, and with Nancy, Building the Knowledge Management Network. The practices in these books are now industry standards. And they had a consultancy for a while, they called Sochi Alchemy. I saw him speak at numerous professional events over the course of 20 plus years. He was always listened to carefully, treated with great respect. Over time, a true elder, often quoted by others in their talks. And Cliff increasingly focused on sustainability and dealing with the changing climate. He set up a consultancy he called Climate Fraud. He needed only to walk a short distance from their apartment down to the bay tidal marshes to see close up the climate's changes and the enormity of the risk. And all of this while being the patriarch of a big and complicated extended family, as well as a beloved part of our dispersed farm tribe and friend to so many others. He could and did write, and Cliff tells his own story better than anyone, and luckily much of it is easily available online. I urge you, if you have not, to spend time with his writing. It's sharp, incisive, wise, funny, and it all rings true. But slowly, imperceptibly at first, something started to impose itself upon Cliff. After a while, some of us began to sense that something was going on. Something was not right. All through it, for years, every step of the way, every time I was with him, he conducted himself in grace and humility. Even as his body refused to do what his mind was telling it to do, he was aware of what was happening to him. He was fully conscious. He could not speak the words that were queued up in his mind. In the last years, there were fewer words, but at all times, he exuded a sweet serenity. He loved his family and his friends and this beautiful earth. And even when he could not really say it, he always made his love abundantly clear. I never had a better friend, never knew a better guy. So how do you say goodbye to a 50-year friendship? I think the truth for me is that I don't. Like my good friend Nikki says in a title of a book that she wrote, away, but never gone. Never gone, Cliff, because you're always here with me. Thank you.